Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the show Brent Cleaver. He's the director of film programming for the Santa Fe Film Festival, which is happening this week. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte. I'm glad to be here.
Last time we had you on, which was just, a couple of weeks ago, you were out of town. Now you're back in town and getting ready for this.
And I brought the Oklahoma wind with me. Boy, did I, you know.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
So the Santa Fe Film Festival, as we have discussed, had maybe a low year. You're bringing it back in full force. Not as many movies as perhaps at its peak, but every movie that I've seen so far, and I've been screening a bunch of them, is very good. How do you choose? How did you put it out saying we're back on the block and get the quality of films that you've got?
Well, I think we all agreed last year's festival was a bit too small. I mean, when you only have it at one location.
Eight movies, right?
Yeah, right. And as I said, at one location, it makes it easy, but you didn't get the feel of a festival. Now, while the problem in years past has been too much sprawl, where it became unraveled and untenable, it just seemed like, you know, kind of bouncing off two theaters and then using the Lindsay for one screening, you could really put together a program that would be satisfactory and challenging and fun and cover a lot of ground. Of course, in my background, you probably see that the schedule, at least in the feature films, tends to veer a little bit more toward international films. Now, when I say international films, that doesn't automatically mean foreign language films, because international films, we have, you know, a couple from United Kingdom, we have a couple from Australia, and of course, they speak English. But it is, you know, the first thing when people see the schedule, it is a little more international.
Which is a wonderful thing, because there aren't as many international, even when I was growing up, there were international movies at your local movie theater. There'd be a German film or an Italian film or all sorts of things, and those are virtually absent from certainly from the multiplexes and from a lot of theaters, so you're filling in a tremendous need.
Right, I mean, we still, CCA and The Screen and to a degree DeVargas still play them some, but we're very lucky here, too, to have two United States premieres. That means that nobody in this country has seen these films.
Which ones are they?
Before this. The Deep Blue Sea, which is from the United Kingdom. It's Terrence Davies' reworking of the famous play by Terence Rattigan in post-war England with Rachel Weisz playing a role that's been played by Vivian Leigh and many other people. But this is visually one of the most beautiful films in the festival. Also, the other one is going to be much less known, and it's Canada's official entry into the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. And people will say, well, how can Canada be, you know, submitting a foreign film? And of course,
French.
Or French, of course. Monsieur Lazare. And this, I think, is going to be one of the sleepers of the festival. It's about a school teacher who comes to school to teach this class of children who have just lost their teacher. And the teacher is Algerian, and it's just a relationship between the children. It's really quite a marvelous picture. And again, they're excited that both distributors are excited to have this as the U.S. premiere, as is the Deep Blue Sea.
And the Monsieur Lazare is on Sunday, October 23rd.
It's the closing night film.
Yeah, it's 6:45 at The Screen.
Right.
And the film that you also mentioned, The Deep Blue Sea, is on Friday at 6:45, also at The Screen. So how do you, as a film curator, as the film person that you are, and you've been doing this as long as I've lived here, which is over 20 years, how do you keep your finger on the pulse of what's happening in terms of international films?
Well,
do you go out and find them? Do they find you?
A little bit of both. And you kind of put your finger on it yourself, in that I've been doing this a very long time. We're going on 40 years. It's like second nature. It's intuitive. I get a lot of things to look at. I know a lot of distributors. I keep myself in touch with what's going on internationally, also besides what's going on just here or what's being picked up here for distribution. In other words, so you have, we have a film like Battlefield Heroes, which is this really kind of wacky satire of war films from Korea, and it's, you know, takes place in the 7th or 8th century. It has kind of a Monty Python feel, but it has all these hidden kind of allegories between North and South Korea and whatnot.
Can we get them?
Okay. I don't think you. Yeah, it's a very layered portraits. I mean, they're not. It's not superficial on the level that a lot of these are. It has very or caricatures totally. I mean, sometimes in farce and satire, they use caricatures for specific purposes. But there's also the, you know, kind of multi-level approach to this film. And of course, it's in CinemaScope, and the festival brought the print in from Korea, so it's not, it won't be distributed here.
And what's the name of that film?
That's Battlefield Heroes.
Right. That is screening on Friday, October 21st at 9 o'clock at the Screen.
Right. I think you see Ralph Fiennes' directorial debut, Coriolanus. As I mentioned to you earlier, we tried to get him tap him as a...
Award
recipient.
Tributee.
Right. And this is, he had played this on stage. This is Shakespeare, another Shakespeare to screen. But there's a twist here, and I'm not going to give away too much about that.
And that's Sunday, October 23rd at 4:15 at the Screen.
Once Upon a Time in Anatolia is made by Nuri Bilgecalan, famous Turkish filmmaker. It's Turkey's official entry into Academy Awards. Now, this is for your real hardcore art film fan. This is the Tarkovsky of the festival.
All right.
Okay, and we just prepared people to screen for this by playing Tarkovsky Stalker. So everybody ought to be ready. The 10-minute shots, get ready. Okay, this is a haunting, beautiful film about the investigation of a crime and deep in the dark outreaches of Anatolia.
What does it mean, hardcore art film? Like, does that mean you can't understand what's going on?
No. It's usually more to do with pace.
Uh-huh.
And kind of silence. Silent pauses. A lot of gesture and suggestion. As much as told and what's not told. You learn as much about the film and what is not said as what is said.
So maybe you have to work a little harder?
Yeah, and you have to, yeah, and also just the pace of the film and just the long, I don't know if it's the pace, it's sometimes it's the rhythm. It's absorbing yourself in the rhythm of the film. This actually won the second highest prize at Cannes this year behind Tree of Life.
12:15 on Saturday at the Screen.
Let's talk about a couple of the Iranian things.
Oh,
since
yeah.
You mentioned that White Meadows is interesting. In that, this may be the most beautiful film in the whole festival when you look at it. It takes place on the salt islands of Lake Urmia, which is this great salt plain. It's kind of a Swiftian fable about a boatman who comes to listen to people's heartaches and take away tears. And it has this, you know, to use a quote from it's visually spectacular, and it's also, you know, a political fable. But again, when I say political fable, I don't want to, you know, scare people off.
The operative word being fable.
It's a fable. But this is a stunningly beautiful film, highly stylized, and certainly one of the most beautiful in the festival. And its filmmaker and its editor were sentenced to 6 years in prison. I'll talk about that at the festival.
For making this film?
No, the next one.
Uh-huh.
The editor was a very famous filmmaker himself, so for the next one, or both. But this guy's been aiming for it, because all his films, Mohammed Rasulov is his name, have been blatantly allegories against the regime. But again, I want you to come and enjoy the experience and the beauty of it.
We're talking to Brent Cleaver of the Santa Fe Film Festival. A few dozen amazing films happening during this festival, both feature length and short films.
Let's go over to CCA a minute. Or I guess we needed one more here on the A Separation is the other Iranian film, and it takes place in what most people don't realize is, apart from the regime, everyday life is going on in Iran, much like every place else in the world.
Right.
And it's pretty much like everywhere, the same social problems. There's, you know, people have, you know, drug habits, people are alcoholics, people are, you know, parents have Alzheimer's, blah, blah, blah. And the Ayatollahs and mullahs, for the most part, let this go on, except they want to try to control it. You know, it's not so much stop it as control it. Anyway, so A Separation is dealing with this couple who's trying to leave Iran, but can't decide whether they do. They're on the verge of divorce. One of the parents has Alzheimer's. So it's...
Right.
But it's shot in a much more realistic tone than, say, something like White Meadows. Now, this is the only film in the history of the Berlin Film Festival to win all three Bear Awards. That means Best Film, Best Actor, and Best Actress.
Wow. Okay. So let's not forget the opening night, which is Thursday, October 20th. There is a single film playing, and it's kind of, what is it, the big gala opening?
Yes. Well, there's actually two films playing, but the big gala opening is The Artist.
And that's at 7 o'clock
at the
screen. And that's
a silent film. And it's been the most successful film at just about every film festival was played in terms of audience favor. It was the most favorite film at Telluride. It's the most favorite film at New York. It's been the most famous film, even at Cannes, it was the most favorite film. This is an audience pleaser.
Who'd have guessed?
And it's a French film, but it was shot in Hollywood. So you will see, besides the French actors, you're also going to see John Goodman and Malcolm McDowell, a couple other people.
Wow.
And it's good, and people love this film, and it's going to be around at Oscar time, I guarantee that.
So, many films, many more that we haven't talked about, but people can go to SantaFeFilmFestival.com and look at the schedule, and definitely worth... I mean, these are the days that it's actually worth it to sacrifice your day to the darkness and go into
exactly.
one of these theaters and stay there half
exactly.
of the day and just watch one film after another and come out a little bit bug-eyed, but see films that you will never have the chance to see again. Brent Cleaver, what is your vision for the future of the Santa Fe Film Festival?
Well, I think a lot of it depends on how we proceed from here and how well this one does, what the reception is to this one. Considering everything, and there's been some people that put an incredible amount of effort into this, Diane Schneier-Perrin
right,
in particular.
Right, who we had on recently.
Yeah, yeah. I think we're all excited about this program, but we're, you know, are we going to be embraced, you know, and that, you know, everybody wants to be loved, you know, and it's that sort of thing. But then move on. I think that the key is to get a big sponsor. I mean, that's the only way these festivals can work year in and year out, is to have that yearly sponsor, above the title sponsor, that you can count on every time and you don't feel like you're crunched for money. And that's the way it goes. As far as programming, I don't see the program in the next couple of years getting that much larger. Maybe go one more day. And also, it was like, we have... You know, CCA now we're going to have full time, and so we have these two venues. We have, you know, the Lindsay. So let's go for it, because they weren't really costing us anymore. And it, again, to have it feel more like a festival. The only thing I'd like to work on is you know, getting more guests and a tributee and that kind of thing. But you have to kind of be at the right place at the right time with tributees. I mean, that's not an easy. You don't realize how many people get, you know, reject you before accept you.
You would think that people would be delighted to be tributees at
Well, it's
like
just
this.
There's so many film festivals, Mary Charlotte, and they're big film festivals. And usually there's junkets where actors are forced to go to Toronto, they're forced to go all these. And, you know, they're making films, then whatever, they don't want to. Yes, you think, who would not want to come to Santa Fe?
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
But it isn't that simple. It's usually they get asked so much and they get burned out.
Do people come from, or are you hoping in the future to get people coming from out of town to see the film festival?
Yes. Now, one thing that this will always be is kind of what they call a regional film festival, that you do put some emphasis on out-of-town and tourism and whatnot. But, again, when you have so many film festivals, you have to sell the city as much as the festival. I mean, it has to be a great festival and, you know, things they want to see, but you also have to sell the city. I think you make it palatable for people, especially from L.A., who can get here from the West Coast in a easy plane ride.
Brent Cleaver is the Director of Film Programming for the Santa Fe Film Festival. Once again, on the web at santafefilmfestival.com. Brent, thanks for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, and we'll see you at the festival.
Okay, thank you. Everybody come out. We'll see you this weekend.
I'd like now to welcome back to the program James Anaquad Kleinert. His documentary, Wild Horses and Renegades, screens at the CCA in Santa Fe on Saturday, October 22nd at 3 o'clock, and it's part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hey, thank you very much for having me, Charlotte.
So we had you on earlier this year, or last year, I think, talking about a cut of the film that you were working on at that time, and this whole issue of wild horse roundups keeps evolving almost faster than you can keep up with it as a filmmaker. What's going on? Where is this happening? What's happening?
Well, the Bureau of Land Management is continuing on their quest to manage wild horses for extinction in the American West. And what we're seeing in their place is replaced by oil, gas, mining corporations, corporate cattle grazing. So we're really seeing the very last vestige of the American West being eradicated right now. There have been a number of roundups this past summer. There's going to be more this fall. Most recently, a judge in Nevada ruled that helicopter roundups are inhumane, which is a big victory for the wild horses. So we're hoping that's going to slow things down. And along with the release of Wild Horses and Renegades, it's a must-see documentary film exposing the truth behind the eradication of America's wild horses.
What are helicopter roundups?
Helicopter roundups are used to gather wild horses in what are called herd management areas. Most of them are on Bureau of Land Management land, but not all. And they usually push the horses over long distances. They'll run them for miles over very rugged terrain. In many cases, the horses are exhausted. They do damage to their hooves, their legs. Very, very hard on horses, and the film clearly shows this. People will be appalled when they see the brutality that happens to these wild horses. The horses are then subsequently rounded up into catch pens, and again, more brutality happens there. The horses will hit their heads on the very rugged, blunt fencing, and other type of harassment happens as well.
You showed the film in Telluride this past summer. What happened?
Well, the interesting thing about Telluride is we filmed most of the film out in Disappointment Valley, the Spring Creek herd management area, and that's roughly about 60 miles from Telluride as the crow flies. And most Telluridians did not know about the wild horses out there. And when they viewed the film, they were shocked. And probably more importantly, they were outraged and they took quick action to try and stop a roundup that the BLM did about a month ago. Unfortunately, the roundup was not stopped. But again, with our cameras and everything that evolved after the screening, we greatly exposed the BLM again for their direct violations of the 1971 Free Roaming Wild Horse and Burro Act.
You have a lawsuit going on against the BLM, is that correct?
That is correct. What we're suing for is, like I just mentioned, numerous violations of the 1971 Free Roaming Wild Horse and Burro Act, lack of sufficient notice to local governments and interested parties. That happened here in Telluride, Colorado, and it has happened all over the American West. Herd management areas illegally reduced since 1971, and the failure to mitigate loss of water sources, allowed wild horse populations numbers set artificially low and genetically unsustainable. In an HMA, the herd is supposed to take priority over grazing and mining mineral extraction. Short-term holding is inhumane, and long-term holding violates the 1971 Free-Roaming Wild Horse and Burro Act.
Now, let me ask you this. What is the BLM's job? What is their mission, so to speak, or their charter?
They are the stewards of our public lands, and I suggest people go and read their mission statement on their website and then compare that to viewing what the film shows. I did interview a man from the BLM, a former employee, who said if the BLM simply followed their mission statement, things would be running a lot more smoothly.
So in your documentary and what your research has turned up, basically the BLM is in cahoots with the extractive industry, whether it be uranium mining, oil and gas, or whatever, and the wildlife on the surface of Bureau of Land Management land is basically up for grabs and not considered a priority in any way.
Well, I wouldn't go to as far as to say not considered a priority. They would argue that point. But as the film points out, you'll see where the wildlife, specifically the wild horses, are being simply removed for the purpose of the larger extractive industries to come in. And we give several examples of it. We have Jim Baca, the former director of the Bureau of Land Management under Clinton. And his testimony in the film is very, very revealing. And he flat out says, you have to realize that our public lands are run by the oil, gas, mining, and cattle industry. So I think that says enough right there.
So the movement that you are part of, what is your goal?
Well, we want to use this film to educate a vast audience. And we want that audience to write their legislators, write President Obama, and ask for reform within the Bureau of Land Management. Reinstate some of the legislation that was removed in the 1971 Free-Roaming Wild Horse and Burro Act. And now we are taking a federal lawsuit to court against the Bureau of Land Management. And we hope to have them convicted on numerous counts of violation of the 1971 Free-Roaming Wild Horse and Burro Act, hoping that this will lead to responsible change within the department itself.
Are there any people within the Bureau of Land Management who are your allies, who feel the way that you do?
I have interviewed a number of BLM ex-employees. Actually, some are still employees. And yes, I think many of these people are very upset by the orders that come down from high, from Washington, D.C. I don't want to name names here, but I've spoken with numerous people within the BLM who are very upset by the way the agency is run. Also, if you look up, it's called the Peer Report, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. These are people within federal agencies that actually are doing great work. And there's a peer report that was done on the Del Rio investigation. And this is where wild horses and people within the BLM were actually going to be convicted of shipping wild horses to slaughter. Unfortunately, the investigation was shut down. It was going to incriminate a lot of people within the BLM. And so there was a cover-up. But, I urge your viewers to look up the peer report, Wild Horses to Slaughter, online.
Is that what happens to the horses that get rounded up? They all go to slaughter, or what happens to them?
Well, they don't go directly to slaughter, okay? They're rounded up, and they go to short-term holding facilities. And these facilities, they're across the American West. And then some of the horses are offered up for adoption. The public can come and adopt them. However, they deem horses 10 years of age and older unadoptable. So most of those horses end up going to what are called long-term holding facilities. And most of these holding facilities are in Oklahoma, a few in Kansas. And their fate is questionable. at that point. In August of this year, there was a semi-truckload or two semi-truckloads of wild horses caught coming out of those long-term holding facilities going to Mexican slaughterhouses. Currently, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Salt Lake City is investigating this. So, again, I can't really comment any further in that, but there is an investigation going on about horses from long-term holding being shipped to slaughter.
When horses are living basically on their own in the wild in the West, what are their lives like? Do they move around in family groups? What is their kind of social pattern?
It's really amazing. They have incredible family bonds. Just amazing to see the dominant band stallion, the lead mare, and their family unit, how they live as a family unit, how they travel around, how they look out for each other. Just an incredible group that supports one another in surviving in the wild. These horses are amazingly resilient. They can live on a small amount of forage, sparse forage. Their hooves are just amazing. You don't find domestic horses with hooves and lower legs, canter bones, like you find in the wild horses. Years of evolution of surviving in the wild has made these horses into what they are. And they're incredible animals that have the ability to survive and live and thrive in the American West.
I can't help but think that if alternative energy sources got a whole lot of money put into research and development and solar power were able to compete with coal and so on, these problems would go away because the competition for that open land wouldn't be there in the way that it is now.
Yeah, I love your idea. And that's, I think, what most of us are hoping for, that as we're making the move to alternative energies, renewable energies, we're going to see much better stewardship of the land, much better care of the land, much less exploitation, polluting of the land, and the horses and all the other wildlife species will be allowed to live in harmony. That's the vision.
James Anaquad Kleinert is a filmmaker. His documentary is called Wild Horses and Renegades. It screens at the CCA here in Santa Fe on Saturday, the 22nd of October at 3 o'clock as part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. Thank you so much for being with us, and I encourage everybody to go see this very important film.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Galen Ross. She is director of the film Karis's Peace, which screens as part of the Santa Fe Film Festival on Friday, the 20th of October at 4:30 in the afternoon at The Screen on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi. Hi, Mary Charlotte. How are you?
Good, good. It's great to have you back. We had you, last year or the year before when you were talking about another documentary you did called Killing Kastner, which was amazing. This is a film about an actress named Karis Korfman. Tell us about who she was and her career as an actress.
Karis Korfman was an amazing actress. She was a Yale student, Yale Drama School student. And she went right from drama school to Broadway and starred with Tim Curry in Amadeus and continued a life mostly in the theater, doing film, though, in television. But her real work as an actress and where she became known was in the theater in New York and in regional theaters. But she continued until this cataclysmic event happened in her life, which was the diagnosis of a brain tumor.
Now, that brain tumor, which happened when she was still, in her late 30s,
exactly.
Left her with short-term memory loss, which basically, whatever you do, that's going to be hard. But if you're an actress, that immediately puts an end to your normal career. What happened next?
Well, the diagnosis, the good news was that the tumor was benign. The bad news, of course, was that the removal of it was so invasive that it left her really physically challenged in terms of literally physically. I think her pituitary gland was also removed, so that changed her whole biological, her eating habits, and she physically changed. But more importantly, she lost her short-term memory, and this was an area where the tumor was removed. And for anyone, you know, to not have short-term memory means that they can't literally remember what they did, not just that morning, but 10 minutes ago or an hour ago. And so there's no continuity to one's life. So she spent many years, actually, in a rehabilitation situation and started to live pretty much on her own with help from her family and caregivers in her own apartment and was finding a way to have a life. But there was a huge, huge hole missing in her life, and that was her passion and her love for the stage and her devotion as an actress to the theater. And she wanted to get back, and there was no way that she knew how to be back on the stage.
And yet she did, and that's the beautiful thing about this film, and it's also the kind of play on words in the title, Karis's Peace, P-E-A-C-E, but it's also about the theater piece that she did. How did she manage to do a one-woman show?
Well, there was this discussion and dialogue with Karis and her friends, and how was she going to be an actress again? And she was trying to think if she could read books on tape or she could do something. But the idea of having no memory and going on stage and not just the sense, which I think is very important, not just holding a script in hand, Karis wouldn't know or remember necessarily why she was even on the stage or what she was supposed to be doing there. I mean, the loss of memory was so much more profound than not having words. So there were so many hurdles and obstacles to the very idea of getting Karis back on the stage, but she was absolutely driven to doing it. So with help of friends and especially a theater director, Brad Watkins, they started to devise literally a method for her to be back on stage, for her to have a script, for her to create her one-woman show, to add to it monologues that she had done that were well-known in theater that she had presented before, and to also create a way that she would always have a safety net, because at any moment, they didn't know, but at any moment, she might not know where she was. And so, I mean, there was a standing sort of joke. It wasn't so funny, but it was funny in a way Karis thought it was. But we said Karis never had stage fright because at rehearsal, she might have the performance that night, but she wouldn't know. She would turn to the director and say, "What are we doing tonight?" And the director would say, "You have a performance with an audience coming." And she would go, "Oh, that's great. That's nice." And it was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's when one watches the film, you really can't help but try to put yourself in her position and think about what that must be like. And she obviously had an incredible spirit. She was a great actress. She was a wonderful person. You have some footage of her before she had this brain injury, so, you know, brain problem, where she was just completely in her body and in her power, and not knowing where you are. You're on stage, you're holding index cards that say your lines because you can't remember them, and then suddenly you don't know where you are or why you're there. Just the sense of fear and disorientation that must have been part of her daily life is just unimaginable.
It was really, I mean, and the courage she had. I mean, with all of that, the courage she had to get back on stage and to do this. I mean, the cards are very interesting. They devised a special way for her to have cards. But it was very interesting. The cards were not like a script, although they were the script, but they were stapled cards, and they were color-coded. So the reason they stapled a section of the play together was because if they were on a ring, she would continue the cards going over and over again, and she could repeat the entire play.
Right,
and not know that she had repeated it. And I think, you know, another thing that was really important is that a lot of this was in the making of the film, the collaborating director, Rebecca Nelson, was there. And she and Karis also had this relationship as acting colleagues back from Yale. And there was this amazing relationship with them and support that Rebecca had for Karis. And to, you know, to have that community back for Karis was enormously important for her to be included again.
Well, and one thing that was so interesting to me was she couldn't remember who she'd met 5 minutes ago or why she was on stage or what she was supposed to eat or any of that stuff. But she knew lines from plays that she had done 20 years earlier, and she knew her old friends. So it was as if the stuff before the brain tumor basically remained, if not intact, a lot of that was still there.
Yes, I mean, it's a very unique phenomenon, and I think what we try to say in the film is that unlike Alzheimer's, where there is a receding of the person and the memory is getting worse and worse, so that and they are not really aware of what's going on, Karis had a much more difficult, or not comparatively, but it was a unique situation where she was very aware of what was happening to her, which made it much more painful. But we felt that, you know, she was, and this is interesting, you know, with work or participation in the world or the community, we started to think she was getting better, that she was beginning to make a way for new memories to happen. And for her, you know, it was like, and we used the example in the film, of a filing cabinet. She had all the files of her past life in her head. It was putting the new files in. They wouldn't stay in the filing cabinet. They just kept falling out, falling out, falling out. So it was interesting to see that back in the theater, back in the world, she started to find a way to make new memories, which was extraordinary, I thought.
Did that last?
Yes, I mean, it would be very difficult to know which new memories would hold. I mean, she never knew why she would remember certain things. For instance, she wouldn't remember that she had a performance that night, but she would remember very well that she's doing a play. And she would remember sometimes people that she had met since the tumor, and they would now hold a memory for her. So it was very interesting what held memory and what didn't, but certainly, certainly the process accelerated as she, and I do think there's work is healing. You know, whatever passion you have, hers happened to be theater, hers happened to be in the arts, but being involved, being engaged, it does connect something with the brain, and I think we could witness that in the film.
And it definitely seemed to lift her spirits when she was doing that theater piece.
Definitely. You know, I mean, again, work and being involved. I mean, the depression for Karis was tremendous before she got back on the stage. It was, yes, she had a nice life, and yes, she had her basic needs taken care of, but, of course, she lost that involvement. And when she lost that and feeling like she could participate in the world in a meaningful way, it was very, very painful and traumatic for her, and she was very depressed, and I can understand, rightfully so.
There was a, I thought at the time, cheesy Adam Sandler, Drew Barrymore movie called 51st Dates, but it's the same illness. It's the same what they portray in that, and they portray it in a way that, unfortunately, being a silly Hollywood movie, was really unrealistic and very important ways, but basically this girl couldn't, she fell in love with a guy and then she couldn't remember him the next day. I mean, this is a, it turns out that this is, and it has different reasons in different people, but this is a, albeit rare, but known condition, and it's really, I mean, it changes your ability to relate to people and whatever friendships she had in the past. I mean, certainly there was loyalty there, but it wasn't the same kind of friendship after that problem.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, when people have traumatic illness or they have to disengage in some way, it changes, and it changes people's relationships with them. And it's not the fault of friends, and it's not the fault. It's the reality. She had to move away from New York. She had to be closer to her family. She was more isolated in the community that didn't consist of her theatrical world. That was all true. And the other hand, it's you know, it's something that could happen to many kinds of situations where there's certain kinds of injuries or certain kind of trauma that, changes the way you are in the world. And yet Karis was always trying to find her way back. And sometimes, she would go, there was a local neighborhood theater. I mean, she would literally volunteer to lick envelopes just to be near the theater.
Wow.
It was that kind of passion for her.
What was your relationship like with her?
My relationship, I had a very nice friendship with Karis. And I knew her after Yale. I knew her in the theater. I was directing theater for a while, and I knew her then. And it was a good friendship, and I liked her very, very much. My relationship with Karis was not the same sort of profound, deep relationship that Rebecca Nelson had with her. And that, of course, came from being in that world of acting together at Yale and continuing on. And it was different. So there was a different sort of aspect in the filming that I was behind the camera, and Rebecca was in front of the camera spending the time with Karis, and yet we were all there, and as Karis would say, the girls are coming over, party, party. So we tried to make this, we wanted to make this an experience, and I filmed a lot of it myself except for the performance, because we wanted to keep it a very intimate film, and I'm not
right.
used to doing that. So usually I hire the crew, and I hire, people to do. But in this case, it was, let's have a slumber party. Let's hang out with Karis.
And that's what the film really feels like.
It does, doesn't it? It does.
Yeah.
Karis had such a great time, and yet, Karis got to say how she felt. And for us, this was the most important thing, that nobody was talking for Karis. A lot of people, especially in the disability community, feel that other people talk for them and are, characterizing them or telling them in all good intentions what to do and how to do it. And Karis very much felt that part of what she was going through was the loss of her independence and her voice and her own having authority over her life. So I made sure that in the film, nobody talks for Karis. Talks for Karis.
The film is called Karis's Peace. It screens on Friday, the 21st of October, as part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. It's at 4:30 at the screen on the Santa Fe University of Art and Design campus. Galen Ross is director of the film. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Lori Frantz. She is author of the book, By the Way, A Guide to New Mexico's 25 Scenic Byways, and she will be here in Santa Fe at Collected Works Bookstore this Friday, October 21st at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So, byways, that's like those roads which are not highways.
Yes, it's actually a federal grant program, Scenic Byways is. And in New Mexico, scenic byways are not on highways, so you're right. It's the other roads, not the highways.
And so scenic byways, it's a federal program to cultivate tourism, to cultivate travel?
Yes, it's funded with transportation legislation, federal transportation legislation, but it is a tourism program. It builds tourism infrastructure, and particularly in rural communities, which is very important to New Mexico.
So you did this guidebook as a way of basically helping us figure out how to get around the state and where to go and things like that. Where did you start and what kind of things were you looking for to let people know about?
Well, this book was done with a grant through the Scenic Byways Program, so federal money, and it was put together and designed by New Mexico Magazine staff, specifically Betty Brodsky designed it.
Right.
I originally started writing a series of articles on the byways for New Mexico Magazine in 2004. I did one a month. Someone else, who's also an author, Marty Nyman, finished the series. I wrote most of them. She finished the series. And then New Mexico Magazine hired Leslie King, who was a columnist with the magazine, to do something fresh on each byway. But my intent in getting the grant money to publish this book was to get people from out of state to show them that there's something besides Albuquerque and Santa Fe and Taos, and also to get New Mexicans to travel their own state. because I know a lot of New Mexicans who grew up here who haven't been to Taos, you know.
Right.
So I want to get them out around the state, particularly in the rural areas where we need economic development.
And so what were some of the more fun and interesting surprises that you found as you started traveling around New Mexico?
Well, I guess one of my favorite things that I found was traveling Mesa Land Scenic Byway, which goes through Santa Rosa, Tucumcari, and the ranch land south and north of Tucumcari. And Tucumcari's in Quay County. Quay County has dinosaur bones that aren't found anywhere else in the world. And I don't think many people know that. And Tucumcari also has a dinosaur museum, which has skeletons of dinosaurs that are cast in bronze. Another thing I don't think you can find anywhere else.
Amazing.
And the reason for that is because there's a bronze foundry at the community college in Tucumcari. You know, things like that are fascinating to me, and I hope to other people too, that we have these wonderful things in rural New Mexico that aren't very publicized.
Well, that's what I got out of looking at kind of at random order through the book, is mm-hmm. that there are all of these historical and cultural treasures that mm-hmm. are distributed all over the state.
Right.
There's also, you know, natural beauty all over the state.
Yeah.
There are ghost towns that you walk around in, and they're really true ghost towns. Those aren't going to be there forever.
Right.
And there's also the current and past history of mining, which uh-huh. shows up all over the place.
Right. Well, I guess some of the themes in New Mexico and in a lot of the areas that byways go through are, first off, prehistory. One of the byways, which is it's the Salt Missions Trail. I don't know if you've ever been to the Saline Pueblos. It's Abo, Gran Quivira, and Quarai. They are sort of around southeast of Albuquerque and near Mountain Air. That's a beautiful area. Those three pueblos are connected by their connection with salt. There were salt deposits in the area, and they traded it. And I don't think a lot of people go there. So first prehistory, and then our history, which is ranching and agriculture and mining. Those things built the state. And then there's all the weird stuff, like, you know, our connection with atomic energy. That's all over the state. I don't think a lot of people know about Los Alamos, but do they know that the first atomic bomb was exploded near Bingham, New Mexico? A lot of people don't know that kind of stuff.
The book is called By the Way, A Guide to New Mexico's 25 Scenic Byways, and Lori Franz, who is the author, one of the authors on this book, will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Friday, the 21st of October at 6 o'clock, and it's a very handy, it's just the right size, it's got a spiral binding, it's got a map in the back, it's a book really designed to put in your car and take
right.
with you.
That's exactly what I intended, because the spiral binding enables you to open it up and lay it flat on the seat. I don't recommend that you read while you're driving, but it is supposed to be easy to use in the car, and that's what I want people to do with it.
Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.